"You were always my favourite magician." They shared a laugh. Then, lowering his voice, Pug said, "I am so very sorry about your father's death, Carlene." She clouded a little. "Liam told me you were there at the last. I am glad he saw you safely back before he died. Did you know how much he cared for you?" Pug felt himself flush with emotion. "He gave me a name. There is little more he could have done to show me. Did you know that?" She brightened. "Yes, Liam also told me that. We are cousins of sorts," she said with a laugh. As they walked, she spoke softly. "You were my first love, Pug. But even more, you were always my friend. And I am pleased to see my friend once more home." He stopped and kissed her lightly upon the cheek. "And your friend is most pleased to be home." Blushing slightly, she led him to a small garden on a terrace. They walked out into bright sunlight and sat upon a stone bench. Carlene let out a long sigh. "I only wish Father and Roland could be here." Pug said, "I was also grieved to hear of Roland's death." She shook her head. "That jester lived as much in his few years as most men do in their entire lives. He hid much behind his raffish ways. But do you know, I think he may have been one of the wisest men I'll ever know. He took every passing minute and squeezed all the life from it he could." Pug studied her face and saw her eyes were bright with memory. "Had he lived, I would have married him. I suspect we would have fought every day, Pug. Oh, how he could make me angry. But he could make me laugh as well. He taught me so very much about living. I shall always treasure his memory." "I am pleased you are at peace with your losses, Carlene. So many years a slave, then a magician in another land have changed me much. It seems you have greatly changed as well." She tilted her head to look at him. "I don't think you've changed all that much, Pug. There's still some of the boy in you, the one who was so rattled by my attentions." Pug laughed. "I guess you're right. And in some ways you are also unchanged. Or at least you still have the knack of rattling men if friend Laurie's reaction is any measure." She smiled at him, her face radiant, and Pug knew a faint tugging, an echo of what he had felt when he was a boy. But now there was no discomfort, for he knew he would always love Carlene, though not in the way he had imagined as a boy. More than any tumultuous passion, or the deep bond he had with Katala, he knew what he felt was affection and friendship. She pursued his last comment. "That beautiful blonde man who was with you a few minutes ago? Who is he?" Pug smiled knowingly. "Your most devoted subject, from all appearances. He is Laurie, a troubadour from Tirsog, and a rascal of limitless wit and charm. He has a loving heart and a brave spirit, and is a true friend. I'll tell you sometime of how he saved my life at peril of his own." Carlene again cocked her head to one side. "He sounds a most intriguing fellow." Pug could see that while she was older and more self-possessed and had known sorrow, much about her remained unchanged. "I once, in jest, promised him an introduction to you. Now I am sure he would be most delighted to make your Highness's acquaintance."
"Then we must arrange it."
She rose.
"I fear I must go make ready for the coronation. Any time now the bells will sound and the priests will arrive. We shall speak again, Pug."
Pug came to his feet as well. "I shall enjoy it, Carlene." He presented his arm. A voice from behind said, "Squire Pug, may I speak with you?" They turned around and found Martin Longbow standing some distance away, farther back in the garden. He bowed to the princess. Carlene said,
Master Longbow, there you are. I've not seen you since yesterday.
Martin smiled slightly.
I've had a need to be alone. In Cridy, when such a mood strikes, I return to the forest. Here, he indicated the large terraced garden, this was the best I could manage.
She looked quizzically at him, but shrugged off the remark.
Well, I expect you will manage to attend the coronation. Now, if you'll excuse me, I must be off.
She accepted their polite goodbyes and left. Looking at Pug, Martin said,
It is good to see you once again, Pug.
And you, Martin. Of all my old friends here, you are the last to greet me. Except for those still in Cridy I've yet to see, you've made my homecoming complete.
Pug could see Martin was troubled.
Is something wrong?
Martin looked out over the garden, toward the city and sea beyond. Liam told me, Pug. He told me you know as well.
Pug understood at once.
I was there when your father died, Martin, he said, his voice remaining calm. In silence, Martin began to walk, and when he came to the low stone wall around the garden, he gripped it hard. My father, he said bitterly. How many years I waited for him to say, Martin, I am your father.
He swallowed hard.
I never cared for inheritance and such things. I was content to remain Huntmaster of Cridy. If only he had told me himself.
Pug thought over his next words. Martin, many men do things they regret later. Only a few are granted the opportunity to make amends. Had a Serrani arrow taken him quickly, had 100 other things come to pass, he might not have had the chance to do what little he did.
I know, but still that is cold comfort.
Did Liam tell you his last words?
He said, Martin is your brother. I have wronged him, Liam. He is a good man. And well do I love him.
Martin's knuckles turned white, gripping the stone wall. Quietly he replied,
No, he did not.
Lord Borwick was not a simple man, Martin, and I was only a boy when I knew him. But whatever else may be said of him, there was no meanness of spirit in the man. I don't pretend to understand why he acted as he did, but that he loved you is certain.
It was all such folly. I knew he was my father, and he never knew I had been told by mother. What difference in our lives had I gone to him and proclaimed myself?
Only the gods might know. He reached out and touched Martin's arm. What matters now is what you will do. That Liam told you means he will make public your birthright. If he's already told others, the court will be in an uproar. You are the eldest and have the right of first claim. Do you know what you will do? Studying Pug, Martin said,
You speak calmly enough of this. Doesn't my claim to the throne disturb you at all?
Pug shook his head. You would have no way of knowing, but I was counted among the most powerful men in Suranuani. My word was in some ways more important than any king's command.
I think I know what power can do, and what sort of men seek it.
I doubt you have much personal ambition as such, unless you've changed a great deal since I lived in Cridy. If you take the crown, it will be for what you believe are good reasons. It may be the only way to prevent civil war, for should you choose the mantle of king, Liam will be the first to swear fealty. Whatever the reason, you would do your best to act wisely, and if you take the purple, you will do your best to be a good ruler.
Martin looked impressed. You have changed much, Squire Pug, more than I would have expected. I thank you for your kind judgment of me, but I think you are the only man in the kingdom who would believe such.
Whatever the truth may be,
You are your father's son, and would not bring dishonor upon his house. Again Martin's words were tinged with bitterness.
There are those who will judge my birth itself a dishonor.
He looked out over the city below, then turned to stare at Pug.
If only the choice were simple, but Liam's seen that it is not. If I take the crown, many will balk. If I renounce in Liam's favour, some may use me as an excuse to refuse Liam their allegiance. Gods above, Pug! Were the issue between Arutha and myself, I would not hesitate for an instant to stand aside in his favour. But Liam! I've not seen him for 7 years, and those years have changed him. He seems a man beset with doubts. An able field commander, no question, but a king? I am faced with the fearful prospect I would prove a more able king.
Pug spoke softly. As I have said, should you claim the throne, you will do so for what you judge good reasons, reasons of duty. Martin's right hand closed into a fist held before his face.
Where ends duty and begins personal ambition? Where ends justice and begins revenge? There is a part of me, an angry part of me, that says, wring all you can from this moment, Martin. Why not King Martin? And then another part of me wonders if Father may have placed this upon me, knowing someday I must be king. Oh, Pug, what is my duty?
That is something each of us must judge for himself alone. I can offer you no counsel. Martin leaned forward upon the rail, hands covering his face.
I think I would like to be alone for a time, if you do not mind.
Pug left, knowing a troubled man considered his fate, and the fate of the kingdom. Pug found Katala with Lorry and Kasumi, speaking with Duke Bracall and Earl Vandross. As he approached, he could hear the Duke saying,
So we'll finally have a wedding, now that this young Slowit, he indicated Vandross, has asked for my daughter's hand. Maybe I'll have some grandchildren before I die, after all. See what comes of waiting so many years to marry. You're old before your children marry.
He inclined his head when he saw Pug.
Ah, magician, there you are.
Katala smiled when she saw her husband. Did you and the princess have a nice reunion?
Very nice.
Prodding him in the chest with her forefinger, she said,
And when we're alone, you'll repeat every single word.
The others laughed at Pug's embarrassment, though he could see she was only having fun with him. Bracall said,
Ah, magician, your wife is so lovely, I wish I was 60 again.
He winked at Pug.
Then I'd steal her from you, and damn the scandal.
He took Pug by the arm and said to Katala,
If you'll forgive me, lady, instead I'll have to steal a moment of your husband's time.
He steered Pug away from the surprised group, and when they were out of earshot, said,
I have grave news.
I know.
Liam is a fool, a noble fool.
He looked away for a moment, his eyes filming over with memory.
But he is his father's son, and his grandfather's grandson as well, and, like both before him, has a strong sense of honour.
The old eyes came into sharp focus again.
Still, I wish his sense of duty were as clear.
Lowering his voice even more, he said,
Keep your wife close about. The guards in the hall wear the purple and will die defending the king, whoever he may be. But it may get messy. Many of the eastern lords are impulsive men, overly used to having their petty demands instantly gratified. A few might open their mouths and find themselves chewing steel. My men and Vandross's are positioned throughout the palace, while Kasumi's Surani are outside, at Liam's request. The Eastern Lords don't like it, but Liam is heir, and they cannot say no. With those who will stand with us, we can seize the palace and hold it. With the Bastyra hiding, and Richard of Salador dead, the Eastern Lords have lost their leadership. But there are enough of them on the island, with enough of their honor guards in and around the city, to turn this island into a pretty battleground should they flee the palace before a king is named. No, we'll hold the palace. No traitorous Easterner will leave to plot treason with Black Guy. Each one will bend a knee before whichever brother takes the crown.
Pug was surprised by this.
You'll support Martin, then?
Old Bracall's voice became harsh, though he kept it low.
No one will plunge my kingdom into civil war, magician. Not while I have a breath left to spend. Arutha and I have spoken. Neither of us likes the choices, but we are clear on our course. Should Martin be king, all will bow before him. Should Liam take the crown, Martin will swear fealty or not leave the palace alive. Should the crown be broken, we hold this palace, and no lord leaves until a congress has named one brother king, even if we're a year in that bloody damned hall. We've already picked up several of Guy's agents in the city. He's here in Rillanon. There's no doubt. If even a handful of nobles can win free of the palace before a congress is convened, we have civil war.
He struck his fist into his open hand.
Damn these traditions! As we speak, the priests walk toward the palace, each step bringing them closer to the moment of choice. If only Liam had acted sooner, given us more time, or not acted at all. Or if we could have caged Guy. If we could have spoken to Martin, but he's vanished.
I've spoken to Martin. Bracall's eyes narrowed.
What is his mood? What are his plans?
He's a troubled man, as well you might imagine. To have all this put upon him with scant time to adjust. He has always known who his father was, and was resigned to take the secret with him to the grave, I'll wager. But now he is suddenly thrust into the heart of the matter. I don't know what he will do. I don't think he'll know until the priests put the crown before him.
Bracall stroked his chin. That he knew and tried not to use that knowledge for his own gain speaks well of him. But there's still no time.
He indicated the group by the main door to the hall.
You'd best be back to your wife. Keep your wits sharp, magician, for we may have need of your arts before this day is through.
They returned to the others, and Bracall led Vandross and Kasumi inside, speaking with them in low tones. Before Katala could speak, Lorry said,
What is afoot?
When I took Katala and Kasumi outside to a balcony overlooking the courtyard, I saw Kasumi's men everywhere. For a moment I thought the Empire had won the war. I couldn't get a thing from him. Pug said, Bracall knows they can be trusted to follow Kasumi's orders without question. Katala said,
What is this, husband? Trouble?
There is little time to explain. There may be more than one claimant to the crown. Stay near Kasumi, Lorry, and keep your sword loose. If there's trouble, follow Arutha's lead. Lorry nodded, his face set in a grim expression of understanding. He entered the hall, and Katala said,
William?
He is safe. If there is trouble, it will be in the great hall, not in the guest quarters. It will be afterward the true grief will begin. Her expression showed she didn't understand fully, but she quietly accepted what he said. Come, we must take our places inside. They hurried into the great hall, to a place of honour near the front. As they passed by the throng gathered to see the king crowned, they could hear the buzz of voices as rumour swept the room. They came up to Colgan, and the stout magician nodded greeting. Meacham waited a few paces behind, his back to a wall. His eyes surveyed the room, marking the positions of all within a sword's length of Colgan. Pug noticed the old, long-bladed hunter's knife was loose in its scabbard. He might not know what the problem was, but he would be instantly ready to protect his old companion. Colgan hissed,
"What is going on? Everything was calm until a few minutes ago. Now the room is abuzz."
Pug leaned his head closer to Colgan's and said, "Martin may announce for the crown." Colgan's eyes widened.
"Gods and fishes! That'll set this court on its ear."
He looked around and saw most of the kingdom's nobles had taken their places within the hall. With a sigh of regret, he said,
"It's too late to do anything now, but wait."
Amos crashed through the garden, swearing furiously.
"Why the hell does anyone want all these bloody posies about anyway?"
Martin looked up and barely caught the crystal goblet thrust at him by Amos Trask.
"What?"
he said, as Amos filled it with wine from a crystal decanter he held.
"Thought you might be in need of a bracer and a shipmate to share it with."
Martin's eyes narrowed.
"What do you mean?"
Amos filled his own goblet and took a long pull.
"It's all over the palace now, fellow my lad. Liam's a good enough sort, but he's got rocks for ballast if he thinks he can have a crew of stonecutters put your name on your father's tomb, then hush them up with something as petty as a royal command. Every servant in the palace knew you were the new first mate within an hour after those boys finished work. It's all up in the wind, you can believe me."
Martin drank the wine and said,
"Thank you, Amos."
He studied the deep red wine in the glass.
"Shall I be king?"
Amos laughed, a good-natured, hearty sound.
"I have two thoughts on that, Martin. First, it's always better to be captain than deckhand, which is why I'm a captain and not a deckhand. Second, there's some difference between a ship and a kingdom."
Martin laughed.
"Pirate, you're no help at all."
Amos looked stung.
"Blast me, I got you to laugh, didn't I?"
He leaned over, resting an elbow on the garden wall while he poured more wine into his cup.
"See here, there's this pretty little three-master in the royal harbour. I've not had much time, but with the king's pardon being declared, there's plenty of good lads fresh from the brig who'd jump to sail with Captain Trenchard. Why don't we cast off from here and go a-roving?"
Martin shook his head.
"That sounds fine. I've been on a ship 3 times in my life, and with you I nearly got killed all 3 times.
Amos looked injured.
"The first 2 times were Arutha's fault, and the 3rd time wasn't my fault. I didn't send those Ceresian pirates to chase us from Salador to Rillanon. Besides, if you sign aboard with me, we'll do the chasing. The kingdom sees a whole new sea for Trenchard to sail. What do you say?"
Martin's voice turned somber.
"No, Amos, though I'd almost as soon sail with you as return to the forest. But what I must decide cannot be run from. For good or ill, I am the eldest son, and I have the first claim to the crown."
Martin looked hard at Amos.
"Do you think Liam can be king?"
Amos shook his head.
"Of course, but that's not the question, is it? What you want to know is, can Liam be a good king?" "I don't know, Martin. But I'll tell you one thing. I've seen many a sailor gone pale with fear in battle, yet fight without hesitation. Sometimes you can't know what a man's capable of until the time comes for him to act."
Amos paused for a moment, considering his words.
"Liam's a good enough sort, as I said. He's scared silly of becoming king, and I don't blame him. But once upon the throne, I think he could be a good enough king." "I wish I could know you were right."
A chime sounded, then great bells began to ring.
"Well," said Amos, You don't have much time left to decide. The priests of Ishap are at the outer gates, and when they reach the throne room, there's no cutting grapples and sailing away. Your course will be set.
Martin turned away from the wall.
Thank you for your company, Amos, and the wine. Shall we go change the fate of the kingdom?
Amos drank the last of the wine from the crystal decanter. He tossed it aside and, over the sound of shattering glass, said,
You go decide the fate of the kingdom, Martin. I'll come along later, perhaps, if I can't arrange for that little ship I spoke of. Maybe we'll sail together again. If you change your mind about being king, or decide you're in need of quick transportation from Rillanon, fetch yourself down to the docks before sundown. I'll be about somewhere, and you'll always be welcome in my crew.
Martin gripped his hand tightly.
Always farewell, pirate.
Amos left, and Martin stood alone, ordering his thoughts as best he could. Then, making his decision, he began his journey to the throne room. By craning his neck, Pug could see those entering the great hall. Duke Caldric escorted Erlen's widow, Princess Alicia, down the long aisle toward the throne. Anita and Carleen followed. From Colgan came the observation,
By those grim expressions and pale complexions, I wager Arutha has told them what may come.
Pug noticed how Anita held tightly to Carleen's hand when they reached their appointed places.
What a thing to discover you've an elder brother in these circumstances.
Colgan whispered.
They all seem to be taking it well enough.
Gongs announced the Ishapian priests had entered the anteroom, and Arutha and Liam entered. Both wore the red mantles of princes of the realm and walked quickly to the front of the hall. Arutha's eyes darted around the room, as if trying to judge the temper of those on all sides. Liam looked calm, as if somehow resigned to accept whatever fate brought. Pug saw Arutha whisper a short word to Fanon, and the old swordmaster in turn spoke to Sergeant Gardan. Both looked about tensely, hands near sword hilts, watching everyone in the room. Pug could see no sign of Martin. He whispered to Colgan,
Perhaps Martin has decided to avoid the issue.
Colgan looked about.
No, there he is.
Pug saw where Colgan indicated with a bob of his head. By the far wall, near a corner, a giant column rose. Standing deep within its shadow was Martin. His features were hidden, but his stance was unmistakable. Bells began to chime, and Pug looked to see the first of the Ishapian priests entering the great hall. Behind, others followed, all walking in unison at the same measured pace. From the side doors came the sound of bolts being driven into place, for the hall traditionally was sealed from the start of the ceremony to its end. When 16 priests had entered the room, the great doors were closed behind. The last priest paused before the door, a heavy wooden staff in one hand and a large wax seal in the other. Quickly he affixed the seal to the doors. Pug could see that the seal bore the seven-sided device of Ishap inscribed upon it, and he felt the presence of magic within it. He knew the doors could not be opened, save by the one who affixed the seal, or by another of high arts, and then at great risk. When the doors were sealed, the priest with the staff walked forward between the lines of his brother priests, who waited, incanting soft prayers. One held the new crown, fashioned by the priests, resting upon a cushion of purple velvet. Roderick's crown had been destroyed by the blow that had ended his life, but had it survived, according to custom, it would have been interred with him. Should no new king be crowned today, this new crown would be smashed upon the stones of the floor, and no new one made until the Congress of Lords informed the priest they had elected a new king. Pug marvelled how much importance could be attached to such a simple circlet of gold. The priest moved forward to stand before the throne, where other priests of the lesser orders were already waiting. As was the custom, Liam had been asked if he wished his family priest to officiate at the investiture, and he had agreed. Father Tully stood at the head of the delegation from the Temple of Astolon. Pug knew the old priest would be quick to take charge of things without question, regardless of which of Boric's sons took the crown, and counted it a wise choice. The chief Ishapian priest struck his staff upon the floor, 16 even, measured blows. The sound rang through the hall, and when he was done, the throne room was silent.
"We come to crown the king," exclaimed the head priest. "Ishap, bless the king," answered the other priests. "In the name of Ishap, the one god over all, and in the name of the 4 greater and 12 lesser gods, let all who have claimed to the crown come forth."
Pug found himself holding his breath as he saw Liam and Arutha come to stand before the priests. A moment later, Martin stepped from the shadows and walked forward. As Martin came into view, there was a hissing of intaken breath, for many in the hall had either not heard the rumor or not believed it. When all 3 were before the priest, he struck the floor with a heavy staff.
"Now is the hour, and here is the place."
He then touched Martin upon the shoulder with his staff, resting it there as he said,
"By what right do you come before us?"
Martin spoke in a clear, strong voice.
"By right of birth."
Pug could feel the presence of magic. The priests were not leaving the claims to the throne subject to honor and tradition alone. Touched by the staff, no one could bear false witness. The same procedure was repeated, and the same answer given by Liam and Arutha. Again the staff rested upon Martin's shoulder as the priest asked,
"State your name and your claim."
Martin's voice rang out,
"I am Martin, eldest son of Boric, eldest of the royal blood."
A slight buzzing ran through the hall, silenced by the priest's staff striking the floor. The staff was placed upon Liam's shoulder, and he answered,
"I am Liam, son of Boric, of the royal blood."
A few voices could be heard saying,
"The heir."
The priest hesitated, then repeated the question to Arutha, who answered,
"I am Arutha, son of Boric, of the royal blood."
The priest looked at the 3 young men, then to Liam said,
"Are you the acknowledged heir?"
Liam answered with the staff resting upon his shoulder,
"The right of succession was given to me in ignorance of Martin. It is a false bequest, for Roderick thought me the eldest Condoyne male."
The priest removed the staff and conferred with his fellow priests. The hall remained silent as the priests gathered together to discuss the unforeseen turn of events. Time passed torturously, until at last the chief priest turned once more to face them. He surrendered his staff and was handed the golden circle that was the crown of the kingdom. He uttered a brief prayer.
"Ishap, give all before us in this matter guidance and wisdom. Let the appointed one do right."
In a strong voice he said,
"That the succession is flawed is clear."
He placed the crown before Martin.
"Martin, as eldest son of the royal blood, you have the right of first claim. Will you, Martin, take up this burden, and will you be our king?"
Martin looked at the crown. Silence hung heavy in the room as every eye was fixed upon the tall man in green. Breath was held as the throng in the hall waited upon his answer. Then Martin slowly reached out and took the crown from the cushion upon which it rested. He raised it up, and every gaze in the room followed it. as it caught a ray of light entering through a high window, scattering glittering glory throughout the hall. Holding it above his head, he said,
I, Martin, do hereby abdicate my claim to the crown of the Kingdom of the Isles, for now and forever, on my own behalf and on behalf of all my issue from now henceforth to the last generation.
He moved suddenly and placed the crown upon Liam's brow. Martin's voice rang out once more, his words a defiant challenge.
All hail Liam, true and undoubted king!
There was a pause, as those in the hall took in what they had seen. Then Arutha faced a stunned, silent crowd, and his voice filled the air.
Hail Liam, true and undoubted king!
Liam stood flanked by his brothers, one to each side, and the hall erupted into shouts and cheers.
Hail Liam! Hail the king!
The chief priest let the shouting continue for a time, then recovered his staff and struck the floor, bringing silence. He looked at Liam and said,
Will you, Liam, take up this burden and be our king?
Looking at the priest, Liam answered,
I will be your king.
Again the room sounded with cheers, and the chief priest let the din go unchecked. Pug looked and saw relief on the faces of many, Recall, Cauldrick, Fannin, Vandross and Gaudin, all who had stood ready to face trouble. Again the head priest silenced the room with the striking of his staff.
Tully of the Order of Astolon,
he called, and the old family priest stepped forward. Other priests removed Liam's red mantle, replacing it with the purple mantle of kingship. The priest stepped away, and Tully came before Liam. To Martin and Arutha he said,
All in the kingdom thank you for your forbearance and wisdom.
The brothers left Liam's side and returned to stand with Anita and Carleen. Carleen smiled warmly at Martin, took his hand, and whispered,
Thank you, Martin.
Tully faced the crowd and intoned,
Now is the hour, and here is the place. We are here to witness the coronation of His Majesty Liam, first of that name, as our true king. Is there any here who challenge his right?
Several eastern lords looked unhappy, but no objection was raised. Tully again faced Liam, who went on his knees before the priest. Tully placed his hand upon Liam's head.
Now is the hour, and here is the place. It is to you this burden has fallen, Liam. First of that name, son of Boric, of the Condoin line of kings. Will you take up this burden, and will you be our king?
Liam answered, I will be your king.
Tully removed his hand from Liam's head and reached down to take his hand, gripping the royal signet upon it.
Now is the hour, and here is the place. Do you, Liam Condoin, son of Boric of the line of kings, swear to defend and protect the kingdom of the Isles, faithfully serving her people, to provide for their welfare, weal and prosperity?
I, Liam, do so swear and avow.
Tully began a long liturgy. Then, when the prayers were done, Liam rose. Tully removed his ritual mitre and handed it to the head priest of Ishap, who passed it along to another of Tully's order. Tully knelt before Liam and kissed his signet. He then rose and escorted Liam to the throne, while the Ishapian priests incanted,
Ishap, bless the king!
Liam sat. An ancient sword, once carried by Danis, the first Condoin king, was brought to him and rested across his knees, a sign he would defend the kingdom with his life. Tully turned and nodded to the chief priest of Ishap, who struck the floor with his staff.
Now it is past, the hour of our choosing. I hereby proclaim Liam the First our right, true, and undisputed king.
The crowd responded with a roar.
Hail Liam! Long live the king!
The priests of Ishap chanted low, and the chief priest led them to the door. He struck the wax seal with his staff, and it split with a cracking sound. He struck the door three times more, and the guards outside opened it. Before stepping out, he intoned the last phrase of the ritual of coronation. To those outside the hall, not privileged to watch the ceremony, he announced,
Let the word go forth! Liam is our king!
Faster than a bird's flight, the word went out of the hall, through the palace, and into the city. Celebrants in the street toasted the new monarch, and not one in a thousand knew how close disaster had come to visiting the kingdom this day. The Ishapian priests left the hall, and all eyes returned to the new ruler of the kingdom. Tully motioned to the members of the royal family, and Arutha, Martin, and Carleen came before their brother. Liam extended his hand, and Martin knelt and kissed his brother's signet. Arutha followed, then Carleen. Alicia led Anita to the throne, the first of the long line of nobles who followed, and the lengthy business of accepting the fealty of the peers of the realm began. Lord Coldric bent a trembling knee to his king, and there were tears of relief upon his face as he rose. When Brokaw swore his loyalty, he briefly spoke to the king as he stood, and Liam nodded. Then in turn came the other nobles of the kingdom until, hours later, the last of the border barons, those guardians of the northern marches, vassal to no lord but the king, rose and returned to stand with the others in the hall. Handing the sword of Danis to a waiting page, Liam stood and said, It is our wish that a time of celebration be at hand. But there are matters of state that must be attended to at once. Most are of a happy nature, but first there is one sad duty that must be discharged. There is one absent today, one who sought to gain the throne upon which we are privileged to sit. That Guy de Bastyre did plot treason cannot be denied. That he did commit foul murder is unquestioned. But it was the late king's wish that mercy be shown in this matter. As it was Roderick's dying request, I shall grant this boon, though it would be our pleasure to see Guy de Bastyre pay in full for his deeds. Let the word go from this day that Guy de Bastyre is named outlaw and banished from our kingdom, his titles and lands forfeit to the crown. Let his name and arms be stricken from the roll of lords of the kingdom. Let no man offer him shelter, fire, food, or water. To the assembled lords he added, Some here have been allied with the former duke, so we have little doubt he will hear our judgment. Tell him to flee, to go to Kesh, Queeg or Roldem. Tell him to hide in the Northlands if no other will take him. But should he be found inside our borders within a week's time, his life is forfeit. No one in the hall spoke for a moment. Then Liam said, It has been a time of great sorrow and suffering in our realms. Now let us embark upon a new era, one of peace and prosperity. He indicated that his two brothers should return to his side, and as they approached, Arutha looked at Martin. Suddenly he grinned and, in an unexpected display of emotion, hugged both Martin and Liam. For a brief instant all in the hall were silent as the three brothers clung closely to one another. Then again cheers filled the room. While the clamour continued, Liam spoke to his brothers. At first Martin smiled broadly, then suddenly his expression changed. Both Arutha and Liam nodded vigorously. but Martin's face drained of colour. He started to say something, his manner intense and remonstrative. Liam cut him off and held up his hand for silence.
There is a new ordering of things in our kingdom. Let it be known that from this day forward, our beloved brother Arutha is Prince of Krondor, and until such time as there is a son in our house, heir to the throne.
At the last, Arutha seemed less than pleased. Then Liam said,
And it is our wish that the Duchy of Cridy, home of our father, stay within our family so long as his line remains. To this end I name Martin, our beloved brother, Duke of Cridy, with all lands, titles, and rights pertaining thereunto.
A cheer again rose from the crowd. Martin and Arutha left Liam's side, and the new king said,
Let the Earl of Lamut and Knight Captain Kasumi of Lamut approach the throne.
Kasumi and Vandross started. Kasumi had been nervous all day, for Vandross had placed a great trust in him. His Serrani impassivity asserted itself, and he fell in beside Vandross as he reached the throne. Both men knelt before Liam, who said,
My Lord Brokaw has asked us to make this happy announcement. His vassal, the Earl Vandross, will wed his daughter, the Lady Felina.
From the crowd, Brokaw's voice could be heard clearly saying,
And it's about time.
Several of the older courtiers from Roderick's court blanched, but Liam joined in the general laughter.
It is also the Duke's wish that he be allowed to retire to his estates, where he may seek the rewards of a long and useful service to his kingdom. We have given consent, and as he has no son, it is also his wish that his title pass to one able to continue in the service of the kingdom, one who has shown uncommon ability in commanding the Lamutian garrison of the armies of the West during the late conflict. For his many brave actions and his faithful service, we hereby approve his marriage and are pleased to name Vandross Duke of Yaban, with all lands, titles, and rights pertaining thereunto. Rise, Lord Vandross.
Vandross rose, a little shaken, then returned to the side of his father-in-law-to-be. Brokaw struck him a friendly blow on the back and gripped his hand. Liam turned his attention to Kasumi and smiled.
There is one here before us who was recently counted our enemy. He is now counted as our loyal subject. Kasumi of the Shinzawe, for your efforts to bring peace to two warring worlds, and your wisdom and courage in the defense of our lands against the Brotherhood of the Dark Path, we give to you command of the garrison of Lamut, and name you Earl of Lamut, with all lands, titles, and rights pertaining thereunto. Rise, Earl Kasumi.
Kasumi was speechless. He slowly reached out and took the king's hand, as he had seen the other nobles do, and kissed the signet. To the king he said,
My lord king, my life and my honour do I pledge.
Liam said, My lord Vandross, do you accept Earl Kasumi as your vassal?
Vandross grinned. Happily, sire.
Kasumi rejoined Vandross, his eyes illuminated by pride. Brokaw administered another hearty slap on the back. Several more officers were given, for there were vacancies from the intrigues of Roderick's court and from deaths in the war. When it seemed all business was over, Liam said, Let Squire Pug of Cridy approach the throne. Pug looked at Catala and Colgan, surprised at being called.
What?
Colgan pushed him forward.
Go and find out.
Pug came before Liam and bowed. The king said, What has been done was a private matter between our father and this man. Now it is our wish all in our realm know that this man, once called Pug, the orphan of Cridy, has had his name inscribed upon the rolls of our family. He held out his hand, and Pug knelt before him.
Liam presented his signet and then took Pug by the shoulders and bade him rise. As it was our father's wish, so it is ours. From this day let all in our kingdom know this man is Pug Condoyne, member of the king's family. Many in the hall were surprised by Pug's adoption and elevation, but those who knew of his exploits cheered lustily as Liam said, "Behold our cousin Pug, Prince of the Realm." Katala ignored all propriety and ran forward to embrace her husband. Several of the eastern lords frowned, but Liam laughed and kissed her upon the cheek. "Come," Liam cried, "it is now time for celebration. Let the dancers, musicians, and tumblers come forth. Let tables be brought and food and wine be placed upon them. Let merriment reign." The festivities continued. Celebration had run unchecked throughout the afternoon. A herald next to the king's table read messages to the king from those unable to attend, many nobles and the king of Queeg, as well as monarchs of the small kingdoms of the eastern shores. Important merchants and guild masters from the free cities also sent congratulations. There were also messages from Aglarana and Thomas, and from the dwarves of the west at Stone Mountain and the Grey Towers. Old King Halfdan, ruler of the dwarves of the east in Dorgin, sent his best wishes, and even Great Kesh had sent greetings, with a request for more meetings to settle peacefully the issue of the Vale of Dreams. The message was personally signed by the Empress. Hearing the last message, Liam said to Arutha, "For Kesh to have sent us a personal message in so short a time, the Empress must boast the most gifted spies in Midkemia. You'll have to keep your wits about you in Krondor." Arutha sighed, not happy at that prospect. Pug, Lorry, Meacham, Godan, Colgan, Fannin, and Kasumi all sat at the royal table. Liam had insisted they join the royal family. The new Earl of Lamut still seemed in shock at his office, but his happiness was clearly showing, and even in this noisy hall the sound of his warriors outside singing Serrani songs of celebration could be faintly heard. Pug mused over the discomfort that must be causing the royal porters and pages. Katala joined her husband, reporting their son napping, and Phantas as well, exhausted from play. Katala said to Colgan, "I hope your pet will be able to withstand such constant aggravation." Colgan laughed. "Phantas thrives on the attention." Pug said, "With all those rewards being passed out, Colgan, I'm surprised there was no mention of you. You've given faithful service to the king's family as long as anyone, save Tully and Fannin." Colgan snorted. "Tully, Fannin, and I all met with Liam yesterday, before we knew he was going to acknowledge Martin and throw the court into turmoil. He began to mumble something or another about offices and rewards and such, but we all begged off. When he began to protest, I told him I didn't care what he did for Tully and Fannin, but if he tried to haul me up before all those people, I'd straightway turn him into a toad." Anita, overhearing the exchange, laughed. "So it is true." Pug, remembering the conversation he had with Anita in Krondor so many years ago, joined in the merriment. He looked back on all that had occurred to him in the years since he had first chanced to come to Colgan's cottage in the forests, and reflected for a moment. After much risk and many conflicts, he was safe with family and friends, with a great adventure, the building of the academy yet to come. He wished that a few others, Hochopepa, Shimon, Komatsu, Hokanu, as well as Amarella and Natoha, could share in his happiness. And he wished Ichinda and the lords of the High Council could know the true reason for the betrayal on the Day of Peace. And, most of all, he wished Thomas could have joined them. so thoughtful, husband?
Pug snapped out of his mood and smiled. Beloved, I was thinking that in all things I am a most fortunate man. His wife placed her hand upon his and returned his smile. Tully leaned across the table and inclined his head toward the other end, where Laurie sat enraptured by Carleen, who was laughing at some witticism he had made. It was obvious she found him as charming as Pug had promised. In fact, she looked captivated. Pug said, I think I recognize that expression on Carleen's face. I think Laurie may be in for some trouble. Kasumi said, Knowing friend Laurie, it is a trouble he will welcome. Tully looked thoughtful.
There is a duchy at Bas Tyra now in need of a duke, and he does seem a competent enough young man.
Colgan barked.
Enough! Haven't you had your fill of pomp? Must you go marrying the poor lad off to the king's sister so you can officiate in the palace again?
Gods! They just met today!
Tully and Colgan seemed about to launch into another of their famous debates when Martin cut them both off.
Let us change the subject. My head is a whirl, and we don't need your bickering.
Tully and Colgan exchanged startled looks, then both smiled. As one they said,
Yes, my lord.
Martin groaned while those close by joined in the laughter. Martin shook his head.
This seems so strange, after so much fear and worry such a short time back. Why, I nearly chose to go with Amos.
He looked up.
Where is Amos?
Upon hearing the seaman's name, Arutha also looked up from his conversation with Anita.
Where is that pirate?
Martin answered.
He said something about arranging for a ship. I thought he was only making light, but I haven't seen him since the coronation.
Arutha said,
Arranging for a ship? To God's weep!
He stood and said,
With your majesty's permission.
Liam said, Go and fetch him back. From all you have told me, he warrants some reward. Martin stood and said,
I'll ride with you.
Arutha smiled.
Gladly.
The two brothers hurried from the hall, making quick time to the courtyard. Porters and pages held horses for guests departing early. Arutha and Martin grabbed the first two in line, unceremoniously leaving two minor nobles without mounts. The two noblemen stood with mouths open, caught halfway between anger and amazement.
Your pardon, my lords,
shouted Arutha as he galloped his horse toward the gate. As they rode through the gates of the palace, across the arched bridge over the river Rillanon, Martin said,
He said he would sail at sundown. That gives us scant time,
shouted Arutha. Down winding streets they flew to the harbour. The city was thick with celebrants, and several times they had to slow to avoid harming those who crowded the streets. They reached the harbour side and pulled up their mounts. A single guard sat as if sleeping before the entrance to the royal docks. Arutha jumped down from his horse and jostled the man. The guard's helm fell from his head as he toppled over, slumping to the ground. Arutha checked him and said, He's alive, but he'll have a head on him tomorrow. Arutha remounted, and they hurried along Rillanon's long dockside to the last wharf. Shouts from men in the rigging of a ship greeted them as they turned their horses toward the end of a long pier. A beautiful vessel was slowly moving away from the docks, and as they pulled up, Martin and Arutha could see Amos Trask standing upon the quarterdeck. He waved high above his head, still close enough so they could see his grinning face.
Ha! It seems all ends well!
Arutha and Martin dismounted as the distance between ship and pier slowly lengthened.
Amos!
Shouted Arutha. Amos pointed at a distant building.
The boys who stood watch here are all in that warehouse. They're a little bruised, but they're alive.
Amos, that's the king's ship, yelled Arutha, waving for the ship to put back. Amos Trask laughed.
I thought the Royal Swallow a grand name. Well, tell your brother I'll return it some day.
Martin began to laugh. Then Arutha joined in.
You pirate! Shouted the youngest brother. I'll have him give it to you!
With a deep cry of despair, Amos said,
Ah, Arutha, you take all the fun out of life.
This is Nicholas Guy Smith. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Magician Master by Raymond E. Feist. This program was directed by Olivia Mackenzie Smith. Executive producer, Nick Martorelli. Text copyright 1982 by Raymond E. Feist. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.